Fancy a game?
Grass grows, birds fly, sun shines, and brother, I hurt people.
You know what I think I'm going to do then? I'm going to take this right foot, and I'm going to whop you on that side of your face. And you want to know something? There's not a damn thing you're going to be able to do about it.
Medically, I don't really know what that means, but it seems to give me a lot of energy.
It's Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, throwing people under the bus. UNLV lost again, this time to Boise State, again in a blowout. But we have a new wrinkle to UNLV's offensive collapse. The quarterback play has not been good. We've known that, and we will get to Kenyon Ovlad's first career start and his 55 pass attempts. But we now have questions with the coaching staff. UNLV has been held under 20 points in four straight games. If you combine the last two seasons, 2017 and 2018, UNLV was held under 20 points exactly four times over the last 24 games. They have now done that in five games this year, all four games against FBS opponents, too. That's probably the important part. Whereas the only time they've breached 20 points was against FCS Southern Utah. This is the worst the offense has looked under Tony Sanchez, by far. Since he's been here, they've been averaging between 28 and 30 points per game, which is good. It's not outstanding. It's good. It's always been sort of middle of the pack in the Mountain West as far as points per game. And we've always thought, you know, hey, if this defense can improve from being, you know, the worst in the Mountain West to being, you know, just give up 30 points per game, UNLV can go win games 32 to 30 or something like that. Like, that's always sort of been the hope for the last few years in the Tony Sanchez era. We've known, hey, the offense will score points. But now, if the defense only gave up 21 points, UNLV still wouldn't win. They can't score. And Tony Sanchez is, let's see, we'll say he is shifting the blame to Garen Justice, his new offensive coordinator.
You know, and I know that there was a lot on Garen's plate, and I got to help with that. You know, I mean, the transition there was definitely tough, and I think you're starting to see in these tough games down the stretch, you know, figuring things out offensively, you know, definitely, you know, that change there definitely hurt a little bit. But I know we can come back and fix it.
What is with people named Justice being incompetent?
The backstory on Garen Justice, he was the offensive line coach. Barney Cotton had to leave the program in the offseason because he needed a heart transplant. So Garen Justice was elevated to offensive coordinator, and now Sanchez is putting, sounds like, a lot of the blame on Garen Justice. Now, Sanchez is also saying, I've got to help him now, but you're 1-4, so might be too late. Two specific things.
Maybe
Sanchez
wanted to help him a little earlier.
Two specific things Sanchez called out during his post-game press conference. One, he thought they should have run the ball more in the first half. UNLV in the first half threw 17 passes and ran the ball 17 times. Before Boise State scored its second touchdown of the game, so when the score was either 0-0 or 7-0, UNLV ran it 6 times, threw it 8 times. That is incredibly dumb. Like, I can understand you're going to throw it a lot in the third and fourth quarters when you're down by 3 scores. I got it. You still should probably be running it if you're UNLV, but I can understand that you're losing by multiple scores. You got to throw it a lot. But to come out and you're opening possessions when you're still either tied or within a score, and you're throwing it more than you're running it, with Kenyon Oblad, a freshman making his first career start against the best defense in the Mountain West, that's incredibly dumb. Like, that's as dumb as it gets as far as play calling goes. It should be, first 14 plays should be about 13 runs and maybe one play action pass. There was a specific play that Tony Sanchez called out. It was a 3rd-and-2. I think it was in the first quarter, and the play call was an RPO. Oblad pulled it and threw the slant. It was incomplete. Sanchez said after the game that he wishes they had just called a straight run play. Just run the ball and hopefully you pick up the first down that way. Don't give Oblad the option to even pull it and throw it. So Sanchez, very clearly unhappy with his offensive coordinator, very clearly unhappy with the play calling, and I assume Tony Sanchez is going to take over the play calling now. That's what I assume is the next step. Because if you're Tony Sanchez, you have to. Like, at this point,
you need to rattle off.
You aren't happy.
Wins.
Like, you think your coaching staff is not doing a good enough job play or calling plays. You're going to get fired if the season doesn't turn around very, very quickly. So you have to fix any problem that's out there. You have to fix it. Like, here's the thing. He's putting a lot of blame on Garen Justice. I don't think that's wrong of Tony Sanchez to do that. Like, I don't think this is a, like, normally it's like, oh, he's throwing the offensive coordinator under the bus and that's a bad move. Listen, you have to go to a bowl game this year or you're getting fired.
So anything that's a problem, you've got to go fix it however you can. If you think the quarterback's a problem, you've got to go make a change. That's been sort of a theme of post-game press conferences, as Tony Sanchez has really more than I think ever kind of come in and placed blame in other places. He did it with Armani Rogers after the Arkansas State loss. He did it with Garen Justice after this loss. And I don't think that's a bad thing from your head coach right now, because it's a desperate time. And so the quarterback sucks. All right, we've got to look and see if we need to make a change. We might have to make a change at quarterback. That's perfectly fine. You don't have to show confidence in your quarterback when you might get fired if he doesn't get it better. And you don't have to show confidence in your offensive coordinator if you're not happy with it and you think that's why the offense, or at least part of the reason, why the offense hasn't been any good. And this is not the first time that the play calling has been like, what the hell are you doing? You go to the Arkansas State game, 40 plays in the first half for UNLV, 21 of them were passes. Like, this is a team that should be running the ball. They have a very good running back in Charles Williams. When Armani Rogers is healthy, which he was against Arkansas State, they have a very good running quarterback. That's the strength of the team. That's what they should be using over and over and over. Charles Williams had 11 carries against Boise State. He has been the star of the team. He had 11 carries. Meanwhile, Kenyon Oblad threw it 55 times. That is insane.
Criticize the coaches, not the kids.
Like, it doesn't matter what even the score of the game is. It should never be 55-11 in favor of freshman quarterback pass attempts and star running back rushes. Never. Doesn't matter if you're down by five scores. It should never be a 5-1 ratio that you're asking Oblad to throw it.
So apparently I'm not following the team as closely as I should be, but I assume Garen Justice was the O-line coach for all the years that the O-line was really good.
He is still the O-line coach. He didn't technically just get a promotion. He just got more added onto his plate. Which is what Sanchez said there.
Okay, but I also...
Which is a good point, too.
Well, one of the things that people often forget about an O-line coach is they're probably the most important thing. There's a reason that whenever the Patriots were like, oh, crap, our O-line can't protect anyone, let's go get a guy out of retirement so that he can be our O-line coach. The most important position on the O-line is O-line coach.
All right, keep that in mind when we talk about the Raiders. Now, on the quarterback position, I can't believe people watch that game and think that Kenyon Oblad is the answer at the quarterback position. And I know I fall into this trap of, like, a few people on Twitter say something to me, and I'm like, everybody thinks it. I know it was just a few people on Twitter. But Kenyon Oblad completed 43.6% of his passes in that game
on 55 attempts.
Armani Rogers' career completion percentage is 49.9%. Oblad's
17 attempts.
Yards per attempt is 4.8. Armani Rogers for his career is 6.4. Oblad completed 50% of his passes that traveled 10 yards or less in the air. Rogers for his career is at 60% on those throws. Kenyon Oblad's performance against Boise State is worse than Armani Rogers has been in his career. And people saw that and thought, this guy's got to be the quarterback. I don't understand that. Like, and you can listen. You can throw the excuses in there. He's his first career start. He's a redshirt freshman. Boise State's really good. The wide receivers drop passes. But even if you take all those excuses into account, the question going forward is, who's going to be the better option at quarterback? How much better do you actually think Oblad's going to get? I'm sure he can play better than that. Like, they'll play easier defenses, mainly the last four games of the season. But he was 44% and 4.8 yards per attempt. Him getting to 55% would be a dramatic improvement. And that's still not very good. That's still slightly better than Armani Rogers. Like, that's still being a bad quarterback in the Mountain West. So the health of Armani Rogers is a big factor in this. And I'll say, if Armani Rogers is not 100%, you don't play him at all. Like, if his knee is bothering him at all, you don't play him. Like, he's
got to run the ball. The one thing that he's incredible at.
So, but when, if assuming he's healthy, you have two quarterbacks. One we'll say is a C-minus passer and a D runner in Kenyon Oblad. The other one we'll say is a D passer and an A runner. I want the one that's actually good at something. He might suck at the passing part, and that's an important part of playing quarterback, but your other option isn't very good. Like, Kenyon Oblad is not a superstar quarterback in waiting. It's just not. That's not what he is. He's going to be a better passer than Armani Rogers, but he's not actually going to be a superstar quarterback in waiting. He's just going to be slightly better than Armani throwing the ball. Now, Tony Sanchez hinted at a possible two-quarterback system.
Yay!
And it all depends on Armani Rodgers' health.
Oh.
Because if he's healthy, you might end up seeing both of them. I think it's a terrible idea with these two quarterbacks. Because if he's healthy, if Armani Rodgers is healthy, why would you put Kenyon Oblad in the game?
Because it lets you run a RPO where the person who is taking the ball is also a quarterback, and then they can throw it. It could get crazy, man. Crazy.
It's a terrible idea.
I know.
Kenyon Oblad,
it's chaos.
Is not... No, it's not two quarterbacks on the field at the same time.
No, that's what I want.
Yeah, but that's not what we're talking about.
I know, but what if we did that?
So, the problem with two quarterbacks... The benefit of having two quarterbacks is if you have... Oh, Kenyon Oblad's a really good passer. But we think our offense is very good when we have a running quarterback in there. So we're going to use both of them. Kenyon Oblad's not a really good passer. He's 1% better than Armani Rodgers. That's not good enough to take Armani out of the game if he's healthy. If Armani's healthy, that's your quarterback. Your passing game's not going to be much better with Kenyon Oblad in there. It's just not. It'll be a little bit better, but it's not going to be much better with Kenyon Oblad in there. So to me, there's no reason whatsoever to play both of them. If Armani's healthy, he's your quarterback. If Armani's not healthy, Kenyon Oblad's your quarterback. That's it. Fun fact, Kenyon Oblad's now thrown more passes this year than Armani Rodgers.
Oh, God.
He has thrown 100 passes this season. Just for reference, last year, Rodgers threw 117 times all of last season and 189 times as a freshman. Kenyon Oblad's, if he starts the next game, going to pass Armani Rodgers last year for total pass attempts, and in about two games, he'll surpass Armani Rodgers' career total for pass attempts. Technically Correct is brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Every Monday night, Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It's Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Oakland A's could move to Las Vegas.
A story in the San Francisco Chronicle. Rob Manfred is the commissioner of Major League Baseball.
He sucks.
And it sounds like he's just using Las Vegas as leverage. But the backstory here, the Oakland A's want to leave the Coliseum. They want to build their own ballpark. And to help pay for that, they want to buy the land that the Coliseum is currently on and redevelop it. The Coliseum is owned 50-50 by the city of Oakland and the county of Alameda. The A's have an offer to buy the county's half for $85 million. The city of Oakland wants the half that this county is selling, but they do not have $85 million. So they are suing to try to make sure that sale does not go through. So that's the backstory on this. Rob Manfred apparently met with the city council of Oakland, and this is what one of the city councilmen said. This was his version of the meeting. The commissioner pointed out that Bay Area fans will soon be going to Las Vegas to see the Raiders, and that unless things changed, Bay Area fans may be going to Las Vegas or elsewhere to see the A's. Which sounds a lot like using Las Vegas as leverage. That does not sound like Major League Baseball wants the A's to go to Vegas. That sounds like a threat to the city council of Oakland that, hey, this team will leave if you don't give us what they want. And what they want is for the A's to be able to have that land and redevelop it so they can make money. By the way, the city councilor who the San Francisco Chronicle talked to, he thinks the lawsuit that they're using is going to go away. So he does actually believe that this is not going to end up being an issue. But in the last, 2 months? We've had the Diamondbacks meeting with Henderson, and now the Commissioner of Baseball using Las Vegas as a threat to the city of Oakland that they will lose their baseball team.
Real quick, ranked in your personal, like, your desire, Diamondbacks, A's, Rays, and for some reason I always assume the Marlins are, like, 2 weeks away from packing everything up and just moving to Albuquerque.
The Oakland A's.
That makes sense to me.
I'm a Houston Astros fan. They'll play here more times than ever if it's the A's.
I also like the fact that it's, you know, the A's have history at the very least.
Oh, I don't care about that at all.
Okay.
No, I don't care about that at all.
All right.
Yeah, no, none of that matters whatsoever. They come to life. You're going to rebrand the team anyway. Baseball team coming to Vegas. If it's one of those teams coming to Vegas, you're rebranding the team.
Why would you rebrand the A's?
Why would you be the Las Vegas Athletics?
Because they were the...
You're a baseball team in Las Vegas. Let's be fun.
Weren't they the Philadelphia Athletics and then the Kansas City Athletics? And then, like, haven't they... They've moved, like, four times.
Yeah. Who cares? None of those teams are Las Vegas. None of those teams have a brand worth keeping.
The Marlins! The Las Vegas Marlins!
As long as they bring us that weird fish down.
I think they tore that down.
Did they really?
Lights, Lights FC beat San Antonio FC 4-2 on Saturday.
This team is actually scoring goals now. We did the show earlier in the year live from in the net at practice because they couldn't score a goal. They scored 7 in the last 2 games. They are averaging 4 shots per game on goal, which is like 20th in the USL. They had 7 in this game against San Antonio. They're actually creating chances. More importantly, they're finishing them. Irvin Parra has 4 goals in the last 2 games. Preston has 2, and those are your 2 primary forwards. So finally, for the first time in Lights FC history, they've got forwards that are scoring regularly. Playoff picture. That was a huge win. San Antonio was in the last playoff spot before that game, and Lights beat them. It was a nearly perfect Saturday because there are 5 teams competing for the last playoff spot. Lights beat San Antonio head-to-head. Portland, 2, lost. Oklahoma City lost. New Mexico United drew. So of the 5 teams playing for the last playoff spot, Lights were the only one to win, and New Mexico was the only one to get a point. So now they are just a single point out of the playoffs. New Mexico's got 42. Lights and San Antonio have 41. OKC and Portland have 38. The problem for Lights FC, though, is they still don't control their own destiny for the 10th spot. New Mexico's 1 point ahead, and they have a game in hand. Lights and New Mexico play on the last day of the season, so there is a chance that that's a play-in game, but there's also a chance that New Mexico is 4 points clear and that Lights cannot catch them going into the last game of the year. For San Antonio, Lights are tied with San Antonio. The first tiebreaker is wins. They both have 11. The second tiebreaker is goal differential, and San Antonio is plus 4. Lights are minus 6. There's 2 games left. They're probably not going to make up 10 goals over the last 2 games if San Antonio and Lights both finish tied. So
it's a crazy league.
It is. So more than likely, they need San Antonio to lose or draw, and they need New Mexico to lose or draw. Ultimately, they need 4 results. They need to win their last 2. They need San Antonio to just draw or lose any of their last 2, and then New Mexico to draw or lose one of their next 2 games. If all of that happens, Lights FC are in the playoffs.
And
more than likely, they're all lose, though. It's probably what's more than likely going to happen.
And so you'll get playoff pooper scooping?
They won't get a home game. They won't get a home game. They've got to be, the 6 or the 7 seed to get a home game. So they won't get a home
game. They're not going to take you on the road? They're not going to take the Llamas on the road?
By the way, Llama Pooper Scooper, we're up to $427.
Whoa!
Thanks, Dad. So we need to raise $500. So we're $73 short of getting to $500.
Oh, man. I'm waiting for your other read so I can ask you a question about the Pooper Scooper.
That's terrifying.
Mbaki Zhang made a 3 at the Scarlet and Gray Showcase?
All right, I am about to make a topic out of nothing. The basketball showcase, which was before the football game on Saturday, they had a shooting competition.
Did he know he was shooting a 3?
One fan, one men's player, and one women's player on a team. They're competing against another team. They had to make a layup, a free throw, and a 3. And Mbaki Zhang went 1 for 3 on 3-pointers in this competition.
That's 33%.
And in their 5-minute warm-up before they actually did the competition, he was shooting 3s. So I am fully prepared for Mbaki Zhang to start launching 3s this season. He has taken 167 shots in his career. Only two of them have been threes. Both of them have been missed. If I remember correctly, they were both, oh crap, the ball's in my hands with 2 seconds left on the shot clock. I have to shoot it. If all of a sudden he's shooting threes, oh my God, it'll be terrific.
Who's going to get the rebound?
You don't rebound anymore. Offensive rebounding is so 1984. In reality, with Mbaki Zhang, this is all I think he needs to do. They're going to play, what, 12 or 13 non-conference games. If he takes like 20 threes in the non-conference, a little more than one a game, and he makes like six of them, right? That's not even the college average, right? He just makes six threes. That might be enough for it to end up on scouting reports once they get to conference play. That might be enough to where Mountain West teams are like, that guy's going to shoot threes. Well, we don't want to give up a wide open three. We don't really need to like contest it, but we need to like kind of give him a little bit of respect. If they can get that out of Mbaki Zhang, that is unbelievably huge for the offense, because all of a sudden you go from having, you know, four guys that can shoot most of the time on the floor and Mbaki Zhang, who you'll try to hide him in the short corner or whatever, and teams might not respect him if he just goes out beyond that. All of a sudden, all five guys on the floor could stand at the three-point line, and defenses kind of sort of have to defend all five of them. That's incredible. Like, the lane will be so much more open. And if Mbaki Zhang, like, the thing is, if you can put Mbaki Zhang in the corner or wherever he is, and Hardy drives, the center for the other team helps, and Hardy kicks it to him, and he can hit just like 32% of them. Like, that's going to be a massive win for UNLV. Like, that's going to be a huge thing for UNLV. Again, Scarlet and Gray showcase, don't take it too seriously, but Mbaki Zhang shooting threes would be hilarious and awesome in season.
Okay, I have one question. What is his form? How does his form look?
I mean, it doesn't look awful. He's okay. He's almost 7 feet tall, so it's he's stroking it. But no, you wouldn't see it and think,
silky.
Yeah, you don't watch it and think, wow, that guy definitely can't make. Like, Amori Hardy doesn't have good form. Amori Hardy throws up knuckleballs and they go in sometimes. So it's not a terrible form, but it's not like, you're not like, oh God, that's how we have to model all of our kids' shots from here on out.
I was just hoping for the shot put. Like, there's no arc on that ball. Just, it literally leaves his hand, and then it's like a laser.
And he makes 35% of them.
Yeah. Vontaze Burfict's appeal will be heard on Tuesday.
So, Vontaze Burfict suspended for the year for his hit on Jack Doyle, and he is appealing that. What is funny about this is that Adam Schefter had a report that the NFL went and found another targeting type hit against the Colts, where Vontaze Burfict blew up Nyheim Hines, who it looked like it was not a great camera angle, but it looked like he went forearm to the head on Nyheim Hines. Hines was a receiver on the play that the ball was not thrown to. Jacoby Brissett was actually scrambling in the opposite direction, so Burfict ran away from the ball to go hit a receiver that was not having the ball thrown to him. So it does sound kind of crappy of the NFL to go back and be like, well, look at all these other things we found in your past. But here's what I'm assuming is the reason. Burfict in this appeal is going to argue that he should not be suspended for the season because he was trying to make a football play. On that hit against Jack Doyle, Jack Doyle had just caught the pass. Vontaze Burfict was going to tackle him or try to knock the ball. Like, he was making a play on the ball. He was making a football type of play. Yeah, he hit him helmet to helmet, so it's a penalty, but that's not worthy.
I mean, he also threw his forearm up, so in case he missed on the helmet to helmet.
But he's going to try to argue that's not worthy of a year-long suspension. I was tackling the ball, and what the NFL has with this second hit on Nyheim Hines is an example of Burfict going out of his way to make a dirty hit. And I think that's why they're going to potentially use this. The ball's on the other side of the field, and Burfict's going headhunting on Nyheim Hines. So that, I imagine, is why the NFL is doing this, because Burfict is going to say, look at me. Like, I'm innocent. And they're like, no, you're not. Look at this crap. I have to imagine, he's going to get a lifetime ban, right?
I mean, maybe
can he appeal and get a harsher punishment? Is that possible? Because,
on appeal, death penalty.
I almost feel like there's a chance he gets a, soft lifetime ban, where it's like he's not actually banned forever, but teams just don't want him. Because, like, the Raiders this year, they made him their captain. He was the captain of the D. He was the one wearing the green sticker for him. Do they still do the green sticker? He was the one with the communications from the defensive coordinator in his helmet. They gave him a ton of responsibility, and now he's gone. If you're any other NFL team, you can't bring him in and give him responsibility like that because you might lose him at any time for the rest of the season. I guess you could bring him in as, like, your fifth linebacker.
At what point in, like, I assume he's bringing a lawyer. I could be wrong, but...
Hope he's not.
He's representing himself. I brought a PowerPoint presentation that will prove my innocence. No, but at what point when you're like, I'm representing Vontaze Burfict, do you go, I got no shot at this?
Yeah, I don't know. When he calls you.
you're just waiting for the check to clear.
Yeah, the money's up front, right? Okay, I'll take it. Technically Correct is brought to you by Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers and the Fashion Show Mall. Do you have unwanted diamonds and jewelry? Michael E. Menden pays the highest cash amounts for your unwanted diamonds, gold, jewelry, and watches in any condition. You can even trade in those unwanted items towards a new jewelry treasure. Are you getting engaged or married? You must see our friends at Michael E. Menden for the largest selection of custom engagement ring designs and the very best prices on diamonds and wedding rings. No one beats Michael E. Menden Diamond Jewelers, the most trusted for over 30 years.
Is all of this a, like, con by you so that way you can, while you're out there doing your pooper scooper thing, you can propose on the field?
Would be a great idea.
You think you
using llamas?
Yeah, and poop.
Yeah, but in-stadium proposals are a nightmare.
Well, I assume that's why you had Cassie on
to get some tips.
Yeah,
the best,
like,
way
she
to do
can
it.
He'll design the whole thing.
Terrible idea. I think I'd get a no.
I hope you do.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
This is the code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
We were too early. We go back to week 3. Before week 3. I had said the next 3 games to the Raiders were going to determine if they were tanking or going for the playoffs. They were 1-1 at the time. Said if they went 2-1 or 3-0, they'd be in the playoff hunt. Then they got embarrassed by the Vikings, 34-14. And we jumped on board the tanking train way too early. Way too early, because they beat the Colts and the Bears, and they're 3-2. And they're going to the playoffs. Or at least they're going to try.
Steve's confusing,
very
man.
Very confusing. So, all right, here's the thing.
They're going to wind up with, like, the 11th pick and just be like, eh.
Worse than that. They're going to be the miss the playoffs by a game. There's a tie. They'll miss the playoffs by half a game and get an even worse pick. So, they beat the Bears, and what I find interesting is kind of how they beat the Bears is how they built the team in the offseason. Good run defense, good run offense. That's where they spent their money, save for Antonio Brown. But where they spent their money in the offseason was trying to get a good run game and trying to stop the run. So the run defense entered this week 9th in DVOA against the run. 9th in basically run defense efficiency. They played the Bears. The Bears had 42 rushing yards on 17 carries. The Bears' longest run of the game was for 6 yards. That is as dominant as a run performance pretty much as you're going to have in the NFL. And if you look at the entire season, 5 games, Dalvin Cook and the Vikings are the only team that have run on the Raiders with any success whatsoever. They've been dominant in the 4 other games against running teams. Then you look at the other side, the running offense. Josh Jacobs goes for 123 yards on 26 carries. He had a lot of good runs. He also had, I think it was about 20, it ended up being 26% of his carries were for 3 yards or less. So there was a good chunk of his carries where he actually got stuffed for pretty much nothing. That brought his yards per carry down to under 5 in that game. But the offensive line, I thought there were a handful of plays, but the offensive line was really good, and it made it really easy for Jacobs. His first touchdown, there were 2 linemen. There was a 12-yard run, and there were 2 linemen standing within the 5-yard line just sort of waiting for him. Like, that's how good they blocked on that play, that Jacobs doesn't get touched, and there's still 2 linemen just waiting for him at the goal line. So I thought the offensive line had a handful of plays that were awesome, and Jacobs had a handful of plays where he made, you know, a 5-yard gain into 21. And stuff like that. So the run game was pretty much outstanding, at least in the first half of that game. And that's sort of the impressive part of that game, is they crushed the Bears. Like, they were simply better, at least in the first half, than the Bears. Like, just completely dominated that first half. And it's largely because the run defense is so good and the run offense is so good. The unimpressive part of the win over the Bears is what they did against Chase Daniel. And that sort of becomes the question for the future. Can the Raiders' defense perform well against good quarterbacks? Because they have three wins this year, and the opposing quarterbacks that they've beaten are Joe Flacco, Jacoby Brissett, and Chase Daniel. And for all of those teams...
Murderers Row!
For all of those teams, with a good run defense, the Raiders basically set themselves up so that when they play a bad quarterback, they make the bad quarterback beat them. They're not going to let, you know, Marlon Mack or Tariq Cohen run all over them. They're going to slow those guys down, and you're going to make Jacoby Brissett throw for a bunch of yards and touchdowns. You're going to make Chase Daniel throw for a bunch of yards and touchdowns. We saw Brissett threw for over 300 yards. Like, he had some success through the air. We saw the Bears, specifically with Allen Robinson, have some success throwing the ball in the second half. So the bad quarterbacks can still move the ball. They just can't do it for the whole game. They just can't do it consistently enough. So the Raiders now have a bye week, and then they come back and they get Aaron Rodgers, Deshaun Watson, Matt Stafford, Phillip Rivers for their next four games.
Two of those are winnable.
Those four quarterbacks are the second through fifth best quarterbacks they will have played this season. Pat Mahomes is number one. But then after that, these are the next four best quarterbacks they will have played. All of those are better than Flacco, Brissett, Cousins, and Chase Daniel. So the next four games is when we'll kind of find out, hey, does building a good run defense actually mean you can beat good teams in the NFL? Or do teams with a good quarterback, they're just going to throw all over you regardless of how good your run defense is? That's what we'll find out. The interesting thing, though, if you start trying to figure out, can the Raiders get to 9-10 wins and make the playoffs? They still have the Bengals, the Jets, the Titans, the Jags, and the Broncos on their schedule.
Well, the Jags, that's an L.
Probably. They'll lose one of those. But like,
oh, no, I just see, you know,
Gardner Minshew is my probably the best quarterback.
Yeah. My boyfriend, Gardner, he's going to throw for 450 yards.
So
seven touchdowns.
Those five teams, the Raiders, based on what they've done so far, they're going 4-1 in those five games. They've shown they're going to beat most teams that don't have a good quarterback because they're not going to let them run for anything on them. So they're going to win like four of those games. So maybe 3-2. But if they can knock off a couple of the good quarterbacks, or at least better than average quarterbacks, you're looking at a team that can get to 9 wins. You're looking at a team that could even get to 10 wins. So it's possible they've got a playoff push in them just based on building a good run defense. I don't think, based on their pass defense and based on their quarterback, I don't think they have any chance whatsoever to win more than one playoff game. Like, they could get a wild card game and beat an AFC South team, maybe. Like, that's not out of the question, because the AFC South, Deshaun Watson looks good. But outside of that, you could beat the Colts. They might end up winning that division. So, but they're not going to win a Super Bowl with this team, but they could make the playoffs based on having a good run defense and being able to run the ball themselves somewhat successfully. Another interesting note on the Raiders is the pass rush in this game. Cleveland Furrell, number 4 overall pick, inactive. He missed practice all week with a concussion, wasn't able to play. So he's inactive. And without their number 4 overall pick, the Raiders got 4 sacks against the Bears. They had 5 in the first 4 games of the season with Cleveland Furrell. Now they get 4. The two edge rushers, Benson Mayoa and Max Crosby, both of them had a sack in this game. Mo Hurst on the interior had 2 sacks. So Cleveland Furrell lines up as an edge rusher, but then on passing downs usually moves to the inside. Sometimes they keep him on the outside, but usually moves to the inside. And now I think it's small sample size against the Bears, but now I think it's a fair question to ask. Why would you force Cleveland Furrell in there if you're better at rushing the passer without him?
I mean, yeah, I would say make him a 2-down specialist.
You can, if this team was tanking, like we kind of thought they were 2 weeks ago, or should have been doing, then you just play Cleveland Furrell through everything, and we drafted him 4th overall. He's just going to play every snap, and hopefully he gets good, and he's good at these things. But if you're actually legitimately going to make a playoff push with 3 wins already, and given their schedule is not the craziest thing for the Raiders, you want to play the best possible guys, and that's not Cleveland Furrell.
And that's your 4th round pick.
Right, and so that's the funny thing here, is Benson Mayoa, they signed him as a free agent, is the journeyman edge rusher, and Max Crosby they drafted in the 4th round. And they're both better than Cleveland Furrell at rushing the passer right now. And so the Raiders usually have 3 active edge rushers in a game. Against the Colts, Benson Mayoa, who's has 4.5 sacks. He has more sacks than any Raider had last year already. He was inactive against the Colts because Max Crosby was coming back and they wanted to play Max Crosby. So the three that they have active against the Bears are Mayoa, Crosby, and Arden Key. Arden Key is probably the odd man out here because he hasn't done much this season. Like, if you look
at... He didn't do much last season.
Well, he was there. He was in the picture.
No, I'm saying, like, he was always there.
But he hasn't even done that. Down. He hasn't even done that this year. So, if you're the Raiders and you're trying to win...
Well, maybe they're keying off of him. They're like, oh, that guy, he'll get back.
If you're the Raiders and you're saying, what's our best pass rush options? Cleveland Ferrell is at best there. Like, of who you're going to make... Who you're going to make inactive, it's either Arden Key or Cleveland Ferrell. It's
I'd
one of those two.
Probably make it Ferrell over...
No, Ferrell has more versatility. Arden Key hasn't done it. What are you doing? You're just hating on Cleveland Ferrell to hate on Cleveland Ferrell. He's better than Arden Key.
Okay.
They have a good run defense.
I thought we were doing pass rush only. If you had to pick...
You're only keeping three of those four active. Cleveland Ferrell has more value than Arden Key.
Oh, of course. Yeah, as a run.
Yes. So you're making Arden Key more than likely inactive. But that's the decision.
Then I missed...
That's your decision. You can't you can't make Benson Mayoa inactive again. You just can't do it. He's the best guy on the team. What was it? Next Gen Stats had him at 8 pressures on 24 pass rushes against the Bears. That is twice as many as any single Raider has had in a game since they traded Mac. He's unbelievable. He's the best pass rusher they've had since they traded Cleveland Mac. You can't make that guy inactive. And Max Crosby's better than Cleveland Ferrell, so you have to have that guy. So it's disappointing. The disappointing part is that your fourth overall pick isn't very good. The good part is that the two spare parts you picked up are actually kind of good. Or at least they're better than last year, which isn't that hard to clear.
All right. Will you explain to me how you can throw 32 passes, complete 25 of them, and only get 229 yards?
You don't have any wide receivers.
Yeah.
The Raiders threw to Foster Moreau, three times in this game? Four times. Four targets or four catches?
Four receptions for 46 yards.
Look at that. Darren Waller actually didn't have a huge game.
Four receptions for 39 yards.
Yeah, I thought Darren Waller was going to be a monster in this one because they had no receivers.
Holy crap. I thought you were joking, but no, seriously. It's Foster Moreau, four catches. Darren Waller, four catches. Derek Carrier, two catches. Joshua Jacobs, three catches. Andre Washington, three catches. Jalen Richard, two catches.
Yeah, they didn't throw to wide receivers. What did Renfro have? Two catches?
Renfro had one catch for 12 yards.
Yeah. They tried to throw to Trevor Davis at the goal line, and he fumbled.
Hey, four catches for 42
for
yards.
Trevor Davis? Yeah, he was the number one wide receiver option for the Raiders, and he fumbled on the goal line. By the way, that game
what
in itself.
What is this game plan?
Yeah, okay, that game, the Raiders did... maybe this is the most impressive part of the win for the Raiders. The Raiders did so many things that they should have lost that game. Richie, on the first drive of the game, the Raiders drive into field goal range, and Richie Incognito just slams a guy's head into the ground after the play, gets 15 yards, and they get knocked out of it. Instead of a 39-yard field goal, they punt.
What he learned in group was to count to 10.
He forgot to count to 10. They did... John Gruden challenged a play without seeing a replay.
Oh, good God.
That might have been the worst thing they did.
I don't know. My favorite moment was the... Apparently, Josh Jacobs didn't know the play.
That, too. They just threw... They tried to throw the Bears the game. They're up 17-0.
They threw the ball 30 yards.
The Raiders are up 17-0. It's the end, close to the end of the first half. And I'm like, the Bears could go down and get some points, and then they get the ball to start the second half. This could be 17-10 by the time the Raiders get the ball again. Bears don't score to end the half. Bears don't score on the first drive of the second half. But Derek Carr and Josh Jacobs can't figure out how to do a toss, maybe a handoff play, and Josh Jacobs just keeps running, and the ball goes 10 yards past him. And Josh Jacobs made no effort to recover that fumble. None whatsoever. He just sort of ran to it and looked at it, and the Bears jumped on it. And then all of a sudden, they did so many things they should have lost that game, and they still won. So maybe that's the most impressive part, that wasn't even the best Raiders yet.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is
the dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically correct.
You guys think Jared's bad on the air? You should hear him talking during breaks. What a nightmare. Are the Golden Knights actually awesome? Or are the Golden Knights just really, really lucky that they played a terrible Sharks team in the first two games? Or does a two-game sample size not mean anything? But if the Sharks are going to be this bad, by the way, Golden Knights are going to run away with the Pacific Division. The Golden Knights, Oilers, and Ducks are all 2-0-0 on the season. That's your three-horse race for the Pacific Division. All right, we got to bring back a segment. We've had to rework this, get it ready to go. It's Tay-Tay stat of the day.
I'm out here flexing and all y'all broke-ass haters. Walk up in the club, it's a Tay money army. $100 bills, ain't no damn change on me. Lil Tay out here balling in the IA. I dropped 200 racks on this car. And I'm only 9 years old. I got the keys to this car.
Tay-Tay stat of the day.
Nick Haig has the worst Corsi of any Golden Knight. And I don't say that just as a way to say Jake Bischoff should be on the team and then the lineup. Who am I kidding? Yes, I am. But the reason Nick Haig has the worst Corsi of any Golden Knight is because of Derek Englund. Nick Haig's Corsi is 37% this year. Englund's Corsi is 38%. By the way, Corsi is just a percentage of total shots taken. So that means when Derek Englund's been on the ice, only 38% of the total shots have been by the Golden Knights. But to further illustrate Derek Englund, if you take Nick Holden, this year when he's played with Derek Englund, his Corsi is 31%. When he has played with any other defenseman, it is 64%. It's a two-game sample size. San Jose is also a Corsi monster. Their strategy is usually just to shoot a lot from the point. But it's only a two-game sample size. Not to take a lot away from that, but it matches up exactly with what happened last year in Derek Englund. He was a drain on pretty much whoever he was paired with. Also, the analytics do not like Cody Glass through the first two games. Despite playing with Mark Stone and Max Pacioretty, Glass's Corsi is 46%. His expected goals for percentage is 47%. By the way, I think we're going to follow the analytics trend and start using expected goals for more and more because Corsi is just a measure of total shots, whereas expected goals for actually quantifies the quantity and quality of those and gives you an expected goal number. So like five wrist shots from the point are probably not as valuable as one shot from the slot. But take Mark Stone. When he's on the ice with Cody Glass, his expected goals for percentage is 55%, which is actually solid. But when Mark Stone is on the ice with anybody without Cody Glass, his expected goals for percentage is 97%. It's a machine when he's down out there without Cody Glass. Again, it's a two-game sample size. Stone's only played 4 minutes without Cody Glass, so that's incredibly small. But so far, the analytics don't like Cody Glass or Nick Haig very much. So bring up Jake Bischoff. Play him in the lineup. Why not? What could go wrong? One last stat for you. Goals saved above average. Basically measures the amount of saves a goalie makes that are more than an average goalie would make. Last year, Marc-Andre Fleury was outside the top 20 in the NHL. He was at 5.3 for the entire season. This year, through two games, his goals saved above average is 3.3. He's more than halfway to what it was last year, and he's played two games. Second best in the NHL so far, too. John Gibson is better. So two games in, Fleury's looking a lot more like he was in his career year, in year one in Vegas, than last year when he was just slightly above average. If they get another sort of career year out of Marc-Andre Fleury, they're going to run away with the Pacific Division. They'll probably run away with the West as well, and they'll have a really, really good chance to have the best record in the NHL overall.
I swear to God, I'm breaking your glasses.